And they're all very convenient until they snap together, and then you're in a digital concentration camp, and then it stops being convenient, and it starts being slavery.
We have a very special guest with us. Catherine Austin Fitz is here. She's an American investment banker who served as managing director of Dillon Reed & Company and as the United States Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the George H.W. Bush administration. That's the first George Bush. I remember that George W. Bush. A lot of people say Israel got him pushed out. She co-authored a report in 2017 alleging that $21 trillion in unauthorized spending by the U.S. Department of Defense and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development over a 17-year period. Now, of course, that's all crazy talk. That didn't happen. She's making it up. The government takes good care, is a good steward of your money, and they would never do something that is just... Anyway, welcome to the show, Catherine Austin Fitz.
Thank you, Jimmy. It's a pleasure to be on.
So before we get into... I'm going to bury the lead, and we're not going to talk about that right away. I wanted to, because this just broke today, and I wanted to just get your opinion, since you worked in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, and of course everybody's following what's happening with Israel, Palestine, and Trump and Netanyahu. So we know that, well, it says Trump cuts ties with Netanyahu over manipulation concerns. And this comes from Israeli Army Radio, says that the United States president has cut off direct contact with Benjamin Netanyahu amid growing bilateral concerns. Now, we know he fired Waltz because Waltz was using a secret Israeli app to they were right in his camp, right in his office, right from the Oval Office. While supposed to be advising the president on national security, and there he is on a Signal app that's used secretly, was a secret app just for the Israeli intelligence, and so he was a spy inside the, so he got rid of him, and I'm sure that upset him. U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to cut off direct contact with Israeli Prime Minister Yair Cohen, a correspondent for Israeli Army Radio, said in a post on his Twitter account that Trump made the decision after close associates told Israeli Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer that the president believes that Netanyahu is manipulating him. Huh. Kid, that is some kind of crazy talk.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked to find out that gambling is going on in this establishment.
The next thing you're going to tell me is that the vaccine isn't safe and effective. An Israeli official added that Dermer's tone during recent discussions with senior Republican figures about what Trump should do was seen as arrogant and unhelpful. The official said that people around Trump told him Netanyahu was manipulating him. There is nothing Trump hates more than being portrayed as a fool or someone being played. That's why he decided to cut contact with Netanyahu, the official said. Cohen pointed to the Israeli government's failure to present a concrete plan and timeline regarding Iran and Yemen's Houthis as a source of the worsening U.S.-Israeli relationship. The Army radio correspondent also highlighted that the Netanyahu government has failed to offer a concrete proposal on Gaza. Yeah, because their proposal, they don't have... We all know what their actual goals are. Their goals are is to ethnically cleanse Gaza and the West Bank and take it over. That's been and they used the that's why they're not getting the hostages out, which is why the people in Israel are protesting Netanyahu, because they know he doesn't want the hostage out, because they know his real plan. So anyway, we've talked about this a lot. I just wanted to get your take on this. Do you think this is – it seems like recently Donald Trump has been sticking the thumb in the eye of Netanyahu in Israel, especially with how he's approaching Yemen now. He's got to deal with Yemen, where he stopped bombing Yemen if Yemen doesn't bomb our ships, and he doesn't care if they bomb Israel's ships anymore. What's your take on this?
So I want to see three things from a president who's really serious about this. The first is he makes AIPAC register as a foreign lobby.
Okay.
Second, he requires disclosure by any government official or member of Congress as to whether they have dual citizen passport in our citizenship in any other country, Israel included. And third, we stop funding the genocide in Gaza. So Netanyahu can only do what he's doing because we're funding it.
That's 100%. I mean, Israel, you know, it drives me crazy, many things, but one of them is that, you know, they have free health care, or, you know, they have, you know, Medicare for all in Israel, and we don't. Right. And we're supplying them all their armaments, and we're supplying, which is way, I guess, way worse of a thing. But so you don't, so you're not sure if Trump's real about this.
If you're going to fund a genocide and then play this little theater, to me, it's only theater. So when I worked in Washington, I used to, I didn't own a TV when I got there, and somebody said, you can't work in the administration without a TV. You have to watch the Sunday shows. And so because of the job I had, I was deeply tracking the whole budget, not just the mortgage and housing budget. So I'd be working all week long on the budget, and I'd be looking at where the money was going and how they were racking up the money. And then I would watch the Sunday shows, and they'd go yakety yakety yak. And it was two parallel universes. And the real deal was what was happening with the money. And then the talk was just talk. So if Trump is providing massive amounts of money to Israel so Netanyahu can do everything he's doing while he's saying that he's not speaking to him, I don't think Netanyahu cares whether he speaks to him or not. He cares that he funds him.
So you think that so you're saying this might just be theater, and I would take that to mean that Trump's base, which I meet MAGA every week. I go out and I do comedy all over the country. And even at the Rescue the Republic event that I was at, mm-hmm. I met a lot of MAGA. They are not, the ones I know, the ones who watch this show and come see me, they are not on board with his stance with Israel at all.
Right. And so I want a sovereign country. And I want a sovereign country that enforces the Constitution. And you can't be a sovereign country if a significant number of your cabinet or your Congress are dual citizen passport, you know, have dual citizenship and have mixed loyalties, or sign, you know, what a lot of congressmen tell us is they have to sign pledges to, you know, to AIPAC. So I think we have a serious multiple personality disorder in the government, and I want to see that aired and changed. And the theater and the drama, I don't know what's happening between Trump and Netanyahu. It wouldn't surprise me if Trump was irritated that Netanyahu is doing many different things to make Trump look like a fool. Certainly that would irritate me if I was the president. But as far as I'm concerned, this is just theater if you're not going to change the fundamental structural problem.
Do you have a guess on how a guy like Waltz, who's an obvious Israeli mole, ends up inside Trump's campaign? I mean, cabinet.
Waltz was not someone I ever followed or know, so I don't know how he ended up there, but I think you have a lot of major donors and people in and around Trump and who've been active in the campaign who would have recommended or vetted him. And, and so there's a process by which he gets recommended, and then you go in and of course what happens is immediately you're tested. So Waltz, I don't have a good feel for.
So do you think Trump's subservience to Israel is based just because of the donors that, I mean, because of, the widow Adelson gave him $100 million and all the ape, is it that, or is it he's afraid of AIPAC, losing the Congress? Because if he can't do anything, if the Congress won't go along with them, or he can't do a lot of things, put it that way. And so is he afraid that AIPAC will turn the Congress against him, just like, let me just stop it there.
Okay, so I think Trump, you know, if you're the president, you're subject to tremendous, you're in a box, and the box is subject to tremendous financial dependencies on the central bankers and a whole series of private players. And I'd love to tell you some stories to help you understand, but you're in that box. And you don't have complete control. The last president who thought he had control was John Kennedy, and we see what happened there. So you're trying to operate within a box, and you're in the middle, if you're Trump, of having to change fundamentally the model. So at the beginning of the administration, Secretary Rubio said, you know, we tried to be a unipolar model, and now we're going to have to become, we're going to have to shift to a multipolar model. So you are forced by economics to change the fundamental nature of the dollar system. At the same time, you are subject to all sorts of private interests and donors, particularly the central bankers who want you to do certain things. So you don't have complete latitude to do whatever you want. And the reality is the dollar system has traditionally depended on the Israeli networks for a whole lot of different operations, particularly in the Middle East. So you don't want to just throw them overboard if you're dependent on them for all sorts of other things. So I don't think it's just the major donors. I think he's also a prisoner of the model. And I think the Israelis are dangerous. I know people who are very concerned if they just do what they want in any of these positions, they or someone in their family can end up dead. So I'll give you an example. I have an online book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I've tried to publish it in a hard copy 3 times. The third time I tried, each time I ran into terrible difficulties. The third time I tried, I got a series of very subtle messages, and my interpretation of them was, if you publish this in hard copy, we will kill someone in your family. And so I backed off, and I've never, you know, it's available online. It's not suppressed, but I've never published it in a hard copy. And I'm just waiting till all the people who might, you know, give that order and have the ability to give that order pass on, and then I'll publish it in hard copy. What, but it's dangerous.
What is it about that book that's so threatening?
Well, when I tried to do it the third time, I didn't think it was that threatening. But I think there was a series of people who didn't want their dirty laundry looked at, and they just thought hard copy would bring more attention to it. It's a book about it's basically designed as a case study for the equivalent of a business school class to help you understand the intersection between narcotics trafficking and illegal monies in Wall Street and Washington. And the reality, Jimmy, is our economy is deeply dependent on narcotics trafficking and money laundering. We're the global leader in money laundering. And, and we've been very insistent that we're, you know, our business model is something other than organized crime and war, but it's not. We're deeply financially dependent on organized crime and war. And so it's designed to show you how that machinery works and how they proceed to use government credit and money to kind of engineer the system and make lots of things look economic, you know, turn lots of people into billionaire with government money and make it look like they're making money in the private market when it's really rigged from either the central bank or government.
Wow, there's so many things that opens up that I want to talk about. You know, would one of those people be Elon Musk?
So if you know, we knew in the 90s that we had to change the economic model. And what happened, I believe, is we had a financial coup, and that relates to the 21 trillion that's gone missing. And I think it's more than that, but they've basically taken the financial disclosure of the government dark. And I think there were many of us who wanted to do a model that would protect freedom and protect the current sort of way of government in the United States. And a decision was made to sort of instead pull the money out and build what I call a control model. And if you look at what Elon Musk is doing in his businesses, he's basically, that portfolio of companies is building the control model and making it look fashionable. So you're basically building the infrastructure you need to go to complete control, where if you, Jimmy Dore, say something that I don't like, I can turn off your bank account. And I can literally track you with AI and software, you know, and have software butts on you, like 24/7 surveillance teams that track you and make sure you behave. And if you don't behave, we can, you know, we can cut your credit or we can cut your money or literally turn it off.
So you're talking about Elon Musk, Lane, when you say the infrastructure. Are you saying like Starlink so that people?
Right. What is Starlink? Starlink is a, you know, all global surveillance system. right? So it's an all global communications and surveillance system. You know, what is Tesla? Their electric cars, ultimately on a complete control grid, you can turn your electricity on and off, right? So, you know, so it's a much less independent model than a gasoline model. What is Neuralink? I want to put a chip in the back of your head and hook you up to my satellites. And what is my Grok AI? It's an AI company that can manage the interaction across those satellites and into the chip in your head and on and on. So what is X? X requires, you know, when I first, I got off X and our team finally persuaded me to get back on. As soon as I got back on, they said, if you want to monetize this, you have to send biometric and surveillance information into a company in Israel or you can't monetize your X account. And I said, well, that's it. I'm not monetizing my X account. But, you know, so X is basically a giant source of immense data to build the social credit system and ultimately to build that control grid. It's what it looks like to me.
Okay. Show's over. Okay. So it's turning. So Elon Musk's big I'm a free speech. First of all, it's obviously clear that is a rouge. He is not a free speech absolutist in any shape or form. He's for just like everybody in power, he's for the speech he likes. And he's against the speech he doesn't like. And a lot of that speech has to do with Israel. So you're saying, you're talking about this total, this started, when you say it started in the 90s?
Yeah, so let me go back. Can I tell you the red button story?
Yeah, tell me the red button.
This is where I first, you know, because when I left the Bush administration in 91, I said, these guys are going to get a hold of the technology and kill us all. So I started a company, and the goal of the company was to help us rebuild wealth bottom up, you know, by getting government money out of communities and letting us finance and build, you know, small business and private enterprise. Anyway, and I ended up in a huge fight with the Department of Justice. And I, you know, basically I was trying to stop the mortgage fraud, and the powers that be didn't want the mortgage fraud to be stopped. They wanted to double down and explode it. And that's what built into the financial crisis. So, and to give you the magnitude of what they built, we, according to the TARP IG, we bailed out $27 trillion. Taxpayers bailed out $27 trillion. Jimmy, $8 trillion at that time would have paid off all the single family mortgages in the country. That's a lot of mortgage fraud.
Why did they want to accelerate the mortgage fraud?
Because they wanted the money. In other words, you're using mortgage fraud to access and suck a huge amount of money. So let me tell you, so I began a journey of trying to understand what in the world is going on in the economy. And I was dealing with very serious physical harassment from the process. So I was living in four places on an unexpected schedule, and I was driving everywhere. Anyway, so I'm giving a speech in 2000 to a wonderful group of people who are having a conference on how they can evolve our society spiritually. And a friend of mine who was a healthcare practitioner said, would you come and talk to them about the intersection of organized crime with Washington and Wall Street? And this was meant to be a light and funny overview of the economics of organized crime and how it interacts with politics. And it later became a very famous article called Narco Dollars for Beginners. So I'm in the middle of the speech, and I'm describing congressional testimony in 1998. Do you remember the Dark Alliance allegations?
I do not.
Okay, so it's made very famous by a reporter named Gary Webb.
Oh, of course.
Right.
Gary Webb, who committed suicide by shooting himself in the head twice.
Right, exactly. Right. So during the Congress had testimony, congressional testimony on the Dark Alliance allegations in 1998. And during that testimony, a reporter that I was helping with research was told by the Department of Justice that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all dirty money as of 1998, and making us the global leader. And of course, the number is much bigger now, but then it was half a trillion to a trillion. So I said to this wonderful audience of spiritually of all people, what would happen if we stopped being the global leader in money laundering? So we had a little conversation, and they said, well, you know, our government, the government would have trouble financing the deficit. And so our taxes might go up and our government checks might stop. And, you know, that money, if we stopped being the global leader, that money would go to Zurich and London and Hong Kong, and the New York Stock Exchange would go down. So I said, okay, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern. And if you push that button, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your city, your town, your county, your state, thus offending the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all dirty money and the accumulated capital thereon. And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, guess how many would push the button?
Zero?
One. Oh. If I had voted, it would have been two. So I said to the other 99, I wouldn't let that one speak. I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? They said, we don't want our taxes to go up. We don't want our government checks to stop. And we don't want our IRAs and 401ks to go down. Now, what I discovered that day, the problem is not that we wouldn't push the red button. The problem is we wouldn't go into the invention room and say, how do we turn the red button green? How do we make money pushing the red button? Because you can't possibly grow wealthy as a country by poisoning your children, okay? Not possible. Although if you look at our economy right now, we're certainly trying to do it. So here's the political problem. If you're the president, so a new president walks into, you know, or Donald Trump returns to the Oval Office January 20th, his political guy looks at him and said, the American people just spent billions of dollars to get you elected. And now they want payback. They want their government check. They want their COLA increase. They want their community block development grant. You know, they want help building water and sewer stuff for their municipality, whatever they want. And so you turn to your Secretary of Treasury and he says, you better be nice to the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all dirty money in the community capital, because the president can't push the button in a highly centralized system if the people won't push the button. Right?
Right. Okay.
So let me tell you American politics since 1947. So George Kennan at the end of World War II said, you know, we got 6% of the people and 50% of the resources, and to keep that going, we're going to have to be tough. And so Barry Goldwater came along and he said, we got to drop a lot of bombs. And the American people said, oh no, we're good Christians, so we don't want to do that. So then Jimmy Carter came along and he shivered in front of the fireplace. And American people said, no, we don't want to cut back like that. And so the Bushes came along and said, you know something? Y'all are good Christians. Here's your check. Don't ask questions. And so what Americans want is we want the story of I am good and our check. So we went into Iraq. And as soon as we went into Iraq, the oil revenues in Iraq started going apparently through the New York Fed accounts, right? So now we control the oil, we're making money, but if you listen to the news, we're going to Iraq to free women, right? And to bring democracy, right? That's the story of I am good. So, you know, at Solari, we say there's an official reality and reality, and the official reality is the story of I am good. And that's what Americans want to believe. We have all this money because we're exceptional. We have this money because we're good. We have all this money because we're helping people with democracy, getting women free, you know. And here's the problem. If you look at the subsidy that the organized crime and warfare model has been extracting worldwide, the world doesn't want to pay it anymore. And the unipolar model has failed. We have to shift to a multipolar model. And now the subsidy to subsidize our checks and the story of I am good is shrinking. And so I think the reason the leadership wants so much central control and central control of our bank accounts and what we say and what we do is they can't give us the check and the story of I am good for much longer.
And so now they have to control us with digital currency, and that kind of control is absolute, meaning, well, we saw what happened. We covered it here at this show correctly. Everyone else pretty much covered it incorrectly. was that you call them Nazis and white supremacists, and then you shut down their, not only do you shut down their bank accounts so that they can't buy gas, they can't pay their mortgage, they can't buy groceries, but the people who even are associated with them or help them, you cut, you could shut them down. And you have, and so because of Starlink, if you're digital currency, they know, for instance, they, people have posited this, like they're going to give you a, your own personal carbon footprint. Right. And if you exceed that, they can cut off your spending. So now you can't travel, you can't buy anything, you can't go. So they have complete control. So they're going to control the way you spend your money. And right. you're saying, is, so is this connected to the I Am Good story?
Yep. They're going to control where you go. They're going to control what you can say. They're going to say, control what you can buy, what you can eat. No, I'm, if you look at lab grown meat, if you've ever, we did a big report called Pharma Food on Lab Grown Meat. You know, the only way you can market that stuff is with complete control. That's the only reason anybody would eat it.
You mean the stuff that Bill Gates has invested in?
Right, exactly.
The fake meat.
That, right. Control and force is how you create a market for that stuff. So they want complete control. And it's not just complete control of your money. You know, it's complete control of how you raise your children. So if they want your child to be transgender, you know, they will have the power if they achieve this. And I think we can stop it. But if they achieve it, they can have the power to say, you know, unless you send your kid to the boarding school where we control what they do and how they do it, including illicit activities, you're going to have to, you know, we'll turn off the money for you and the rest of your family. So, you know, or if we want your kid transgendered, you're going to go along or we cut off your money. So this is going to get much more invasive than just, you know, telling you what you can buy.
And so that kind of supports the theory I've had at this show that the transgender movement and hysteria that has taken over, a phenomenon that is less than 1% of people, now some surveys show 17, 18, upwards of that, of people considered themselves transgendered, that didn't come from the grassroots. The theory at this show is that that came from people like Larry Fink, BlackRock, and that they're forcing this on companies and forcing people to push this and forcing this
Correct.
On our society. And you're saying Right. they're doing that, all that. That's another way to – I always said it was a way to divide and conquer, keep us fighting.
You're right.
Keep us fighting. Right. So that I'm onto something?
Right. Absolutely. So this is interesting. So I worked as an investment advisor for 10 years, and I can't tell you how many clients I had who were members of a very successful church, a happy church, a successful church, a financially secure church, you know, had been a stable congregation for many decades. And then suddenly they bring in the whole LGBTQ plus thing. And the next thing you know, you split the congregation right down the middle. The church becomes financially insecure. They split into two churches, and now you got two churches that are in financial trouble. Everybody's mad at each other, and nobody's getting the kind of church support that they need. It's brilliant.
And it's not, it's even dividing the gay community. So it's not the LGBT, it's not the LGB, it's the TQ plus.
So here's what you're doing, and you see this with the Netanyahu crowd. You're trying to take a legitimate community like the gay community and hijack it to get it to support something that no one would ever support. You know, pedophilia is ultimately where they want to go, I think. Or you're trying to get the Jewish community to support and protect you on, you know, the organized crime you're doing in the Netanyahu syndicate, right? So what you're trying to do is you're trying to lob onto a legitimate community to give you the rails you need to get something illegitimate done.
So just before I forget this, I don't mean to, but you're talking about the narco trafficking and how this is the, you know, underpinning of this I Am Good theory. And, you know, it's not talked about a lot, but we all seem to know that when the United States invaded Afghanistan for 20 years and occupied it for 20 years, those farmers in Afghanistan completely turned their farms
Right.
From doing food to doing poppies, and which is heroin.
Right. Right.
And that was done under, that had the protection of the U.S. military, correct?
Right. Correct. That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah, that's my understanding, too. So, and nobody, so when I say at this show, I've said this before, that, you know, people think that our government is corrupt in normal ways. Like, oh, Joe Biden got his kid a no-show job at an energy board in Ukraine because he controlled the purse strings of Ukraine. And then, you know, Trump got his kid a deal with the Saudis. And, you know, that's kind of normal corruption, right? But what I try to tell people is, no, the whole thing is corrupt, meaning that when people have said to me, what do they have, secret meetings? I'm like, no, it's called a session of Congress. Do you think that when there's a session of Congress, they're actually doing the bidding of the citizens and the voters and students and workers and the elderly? And no, they're there doing the biddings of the people who run this system that you're talking about.
And right, Jimmy, this system operates. America divides into 3,100 counties. And this system operates in each one of those counties, one county at a time. So the narcotics trafficking, all going on in your county. The pedophilia, all going on in your county. It's all there, and it comes bottom up. And if you try and, you know, I was a government official who tried to change it from Washington, and the reality is you have an enormous constituency that is financially dependent on the war machine and the organized crime machine, and America grew up that way. So now what we did until very recently is we had sort of, I've never been to Disney World, but I've had lots of friends who've been to Disney World, and you have this upstairs with Minnie and Mickey, and it's all very organized and perfect. And then below the ground, I had a friend who took the management courses. You go below the ground and you watch how everything's organized and, you know, engineered and fixed and whatever. And so you have these, you have the overt world, and then you have the covert world, and the covert world makes sure that the overt world works and everything looks good. And, you know, so for most of our lives, we had the overt economy up here, and then the covert economy, you know, was kind of managed secretly. But if you look at how much it is per person or per capita, it's deeply vested in every county in America.
So it's kind of a parallel kind of a system of when, I forget which, there was a jet fighter. It never really worked, and they had it made, the parts of it was made in every, you know, in like a million different counties. And right. So that everybody had an, you know, had a stake in this thing continuing to be built. And so you could never get enough Congress people to stop this weapons program building this jet. It's kind of similar to that, is what you're saying.
Right. And it's interesting. If I sit down and I get the portfolios, let's say I talk to any arbitrary audience. So I come to one of your shows and I magically get a data dump of all the IRAs, pension funds, 401ks, all the retirement savings of the people in that audience, you know, and I look at it, what I'm going to look at is I'm going to look at a portfolio of companies who are doing the money laundering, who are running the financial coup d'etat for the federal government, and are building the control grid. And many of those people will tell me those are great, cool companies, right? In other words, we are doing this. If you look at where we spend our time, where we spend our money, if you look at the people we support, whether they're businesses or endowments or, you know, you name it. If you just go through our financial statements and our balance sheet and our time, we're doing this. We are going to work and we are doing this, all of us. And you can't change this from Washington. We all have to stop. And it, you know, I keep telling people control and freedom happen one person at a time. You know, if you're going to the office and building the control grid, stop. Just find something else to do.
So give me a concrete example of how someone could stop, like what they're doing, how they could stop. Can you do that?
Okay. So the U.S. government has a bank account. Where's their bank account?
The Fed.
So the New York Fed. The Federal Reserve System has 12 banks, okay? And they are owned by their members. They're private. They're not owned by the government. The Board of Governors is a hybrid, you know, appointed with the White House with the approval of Congress. But the banks and the train tracks that our money run on are owned by, are run by the private banks. So the New York Fed is the flagship, and it is the depository for the U.S. government. So all the money that comes into the U.S. government goes into accounts set up by the New York Fed, including many of its members as agent. Okay. Now, since 1998, the federal government has refused to produce audited financial statements as required by law, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's say that you were running a company and your company was publicly traded and you refused to produce audited financial statements or obey any of the laws requiring a financial disclosure. What would your bank do? Would your bank continue to do your transactions?
No.
No. Okay. But magically, even though the federal government is in violation of the constitutional provisions related to financial disclosure and the laws related to financial disclosure and the regulations, the New York Fed continues to transact and say nothing. Now, let me keep going. The New York Fed also helps manage a group of people called the primary dealers. You know who the primary dealers are?
No.
Okay. The primary dealers are 24 bond companies, firms, securities companies that sell bonds for the U.S. Treasury. So they go out in the market and they raise the money from bonds, and approximately 50% of the money that the government spends comes from raising, selling those bonds in the market, okay, to our pension funds or sovereign wealth funds all over the world. That money goes into the bank account. Okay. Now, under the securities law, if there's something materially wrong going on in an issuer, you don't sell the bonds, or if you do, you are supposed to disclose that there's a problem.
Okay.
Have you ever heard any of those primary dealers warn investors or warn our pension funds that there's something very wrong going on in the federal government and money's going missing?
No.
Okay. So now, if I'm all the employees working at those banks or those securities firm, I'm going to work and taking a check from and supporting a system which is funded with the fees from those activities, right?
Yes, correct.
And I'm completely ignoring it. I'm perfectly happy to go to work and work for those companies and not say or do anything. Right?
Yes.
Now, starting in 1995, the head of the largest state pension fund in the country, I made a presentation on how we could re-engineer the federal budget so that the country could afford to pay for the baby boomers' retirement. And the head of the largest state pension fund looked at me and he said, "You don't understand, it's too late. They've given up on the country and they're moving all the money out starting in the fall." He said that to me in 1997. I thought he meant we're going to reinvest the pension funds in the emerging markets. That's not what he meant. In the beginning of the 1998 fiscal year, money started going missing in huge amounts from the federal government. As of 9/11, there was $4.1 trillion missing. And the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld stood up and said, "We got $2.3 trillion missing at DOD. And I made the mistake. I was helping a reporter do a big story that was going to publish that Friday. I made a big mistake of saying, you know, nothing can stop this story from going viral now. Well, once 9/11 happened and the Patriot Act was very successful at exploding the black budget, the money just kept going missing. It was no matter what we did to publicize the issue. And I was very concerned because it meant the retirement funds were going to be in real trouble. By 2015, I had the missing money up to $12.5 trillion because in 2015, the last full year of Obama, $6.5 trillion went missing. And a professor from Michigan State University heard me talking about it on the radio and said, "That's impossible. You can't be missing more money, you know, multiples of your entire budget." So I had put up all the financial statements on the website, and of course the Department of Defense and HUD had their financials up. And he went to the financials and realized I was right. So he called me and he said, can I help? And I said, yes. If you and your students would do a survey and identify, you know, look at every year and go through and let's find out how much is missing. That resulted in him identifying another $9 trillion for a total of $21 trillion missing by 2015. We published that his study in 2017. Guess, Jimmy, when we published that study, guess what the outstanding debt of the country was?
$17 trillion?
$21 trillion.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to grossly oversimplify. The New York Fed borrows $21 trillion, puts it in the Treasury bank account, then it disappears out the back door, and now we as citizens owe $21 trillion back to our pension funds.
Okay, so that's what's so okay.
So here's the thing: we don't know. We know there's $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments, but we don't know from a cash standpoint how much that is. It could be a lot less. It could be a lot more. What we know is the financial situation is completely out of control. And let me add one more fact: in 2018, the way the administration dealt with the pressure to produce an audit was, they instituted a policy called FASB 56, Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56, that basically said we can keep secret books. And they took the whole government dark. And when they took it dark, they also took essentially the large cap stock market dark, because with the national security and classification laws, it extends to a lot of the big companies who are running the government. Now, let me go back to where we started. All of these companies that are running the government this way and all the employees that are managing the accounts this way and all the people doing this, they're all going to work every day and doing this. This takes literally millions of people going along and saying nothing and doing nothing.
So let me just show people an example of what you're talking about. So I've played this clip on the show many times before, but it bears repeating almost every day. So here is a CBS News report talking about the beginning of this. The day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, said, hey, we can't account for $2.3 trillion. And here's the report about it.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T, the day before 9/11, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld declared war. Not on foreign terrorists.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy.
He said money wasted by the military poses a serious threat.
In fact, it could be said that it's a matter of life and death.
Hey, what's going on, folks? God bless America.
So now you're saying that's up to, here it is, $21 trillion. And you made news with this, saying that there's a $21 trillion underground network for only the wealthy to hide out in a near extinction event. So
I know that's the headline, but I didn't say that.
Okay. All right. So take it wherever you want.
Yeah. So I keep being asked, where is all this money going? And, you know, this size of money can, you know, you're talking about lots of different things. Sorry, I got some kind of cough. When I think a decision was made that the current form of government doesn't work. And so a decision was made to change the form of government on the just do it method. So you
on the
basically,
what? Say that again. You dropped for a second.
Just do it method. So this is a Nike thing. You want to re-engineer the government, just do it. And don't tell anybody. Just suck all the money out and put the government in a debt trap and then institute a control model. So in 1913, we instituted the Federal Reserve System, and that put the bankers in charge of monetary policy. What the bankers want is they want to control fiscal policy, too.
What's the difference?
Monetary
policy and fiscal policy.
Monetary policy, I'm running the banking system and the creation of credit and essentially the currency. Fiscal policy is I control the taxes. How much we get taxed and how the taxes get spent, right? So we've had a balance of power between the people's representatives running fiscal policy and the bankers running monetary policy. And I think what they decided is you can't run a global dollar system with domestic politics being involved in Congress being involved in fiscal policy. And so they decided literally to have a financial coup. Now, the question is, where did the money go? I mean, one way the money goes is to fund the kind of endowment you need to run a private government. So that's one potential place it could go. The second thing it could go is, I think we spent a fortune on building a national security state. Some of that has gone through the normal appropriation process. Some has gone through something called the black budget. But I think they needed and wanted more money than that. And of course, that creates a big secret national security infrastructure and all sorts of invisible weapons, which are confidential, including that are controlled and operated by private corporations. Because one of the reasons this exploded, Jimmy, was when Bush was the vice president, his agreement with Reagan was he would run the intelligence agencies, the National Security Council, and enforcement. And he adopted an executive order that would allow private corporations to do highly classified tasks. You know, and I remember there's a very interesting story in one of the books on the history of Bechtel, where the head of Bechtel tries to persuade Eisenhower to let Bechtel own nuclear bombs. And Eisenhower gets furious and kicks him out of his office. But we're talking about taking the most powerful technology and weaponry and using taxpayers' money to fund it being owned by private corporations. The third thing is I do think they've spent a lot of money building underground facilities. If you need to keep something secret, that's a way to do it. And there was one researcher many years ago who was insistent that that's where a lot of money was going. And so I did a project from 2021 to 2023 with another researcher trying to estimate, just make a wild guess, how many underground facilities, both that we know publicly that are secret, and how much of the money could have gone there. So my goal with that estimate was not to try and understand the underground facilities, but was to simply estimate how much of that money conceivably could have gone to build those facilities. And I do think a lot of money has gone, and it's, you know, if you want to keep something secret, running those operations underground is very, you know, is a very prudent thing to do.
So you are referring to this story here that I'm talking about.
Yeah, right. So that was from an interview I did with Tucker Carlson where I was describing, you know, theoretically, what are some of the places the money could have gone? Now, I think the big one is literally building the infrastructure, the legal and financial infrastructure you need to run the planet, you know, with a private government.
This is almost too much for my brain to comprehend. Do you run into this problem a lot?
So here's the thing, you know, we think of the planet like a body, and a community is a molecule, right? A community or a county is a molecule. And then if you step back and look at the whole planet, you know, it's the body, right? And to understand the body, you need to understand a molecule, and to understand the molecule, you need to understand the body. So I'm a financial person, and I was trained to operate with, you know, very large amounts of money. And it was our job to be able to understand how to go from looking at the ocean to looking at a drop of water and back again. And most people aren't asked to integrate to that extent. And that's one of the reasons financial people drive everybody else crazy.
Right. Right.
Right.
So,
but conceptually, you can understand that.
Yes. Conceptually,
right.
Yes. So, it is. So, how much truth is there in this headline that they've taken trillions of dollars to build, you know, these underground cities, and because they're afraid of an extinction event.
So I think they've taken trillions of dollars to build a parallel system.
Okay.
It's a coup.
Okay.
Now, the people who run the planet, in my experience, are risk managers. And they, if you look at the way they took the money and the speed, I think they're very concerned about risks. And there are many different risks. And we have a section, we do a quarterly analysis on the Salier Report, and one of the sections is called Unanswered Questions. And you know, the biggest, one of the biggest and most important sections of Unanswered Questions is, what are the geophysical risks they're concerned about? And I do think they're concerned about geophysical risks. I've tried to understand what are the legitimate risk issues on geophysical risks. You know, but I'm not a scientist, and, you know, I'm great at finance, but I'm not, I can't tell you I'm great at science, but I have tried to understand the different geophysical risks that keeps people up at night. And they're real. And if you're responsible for managing civilization on the whole planet, which is what you're, if you're running the central banks at the highest level, that's what you're doing. And you, even if you think it's only 5% that we go, chance that we go into a solar minimum, you've got to be prepared to survive that. Right?
What is a solar minimum? What is that? Is
when you get a drop in sunspot activities in a way that traditionally has been very depressing for agriculture and the economy.
So,
for example, you know, there are reports that the magnetic field is deteriorating on the planet.
It is.
Right. And so what will that do to, you know, to life on the planet? What will that do to economy? So if we get a pole shift, what does that mean?
Right.
So I do believe every 10 to 12,000 years on this planet, if you go back, there have been near extinction level events.
No, Kat. You only go back to 1860 or so. They don't do that. So what they actually accuse other people of doing, of saying that you're talking about weather, we're talking about climate. They're actually talking about weather, and they're not right. talking about climate. Because if you're going to talk about climate, you would go back 4 billion years, or you'd at least go back 400 million years. They never right. do that. They go back to the 1800s, and then they talk about how we're in this big heat spike, but they don't actually talk about that we're in the middle of a cooling. We're actually
right.
in a cooling cycle right now. And
right.
they only, but they go, well, but if you go back to 1890, that fits their narrative perfectly. And they got everybody right. brainwashed, just like they did during COVID, just like they did with Russiagate, just like they did with the Afghanistan war, just like they did with the Ukraine war. Just, they have everybody brainwashed to think a certain way about climate change. And it's because they just cherry pick the data. And of course, you know, don't look into Climate Gate, because that'll blow your mind. But, So I've been saying this all along,
right?
That this climate change is being another tool for control of people, and it's not real, because the people who claim to care the most about climate change will not. They want to take away my gas stove, and they want me to live in 15-minute cities, but they will not stop flying around the world in private jets. One private jet flight burns more carbon than my car does in my lifetime,
right?
And so people like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Barack Obama and John Kerry, they're all buying beachfront property, and they're all flying around the world in private jets. And so they're either the biggest hypocrites in the history of humanity, or they're just lying. And I think
So I think climate change is an operation that was designed to try and use people's, you know, people care about the environment. And it was designed to sort of hook your caring about the environment and get you to go along with significantly lowering your economic footprint. So if I want to reduce you to poverty, you know, if I say, look, I want to be a billionaire, I want to live till I'm 145, and my way to adjust is to have you live in poverty, that doesn't sell. So you sell, you take something that everybody loves and say, climate change, we have to cut back, blah, 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 blah. So I just think it's an operation. But that doesn't mean that there aren't real risks that they're concerned about.
Can you Could you quickly speak to, I've seen this come up a few times in Congress, once during the Iran-Contra hearings, and it's called the continuance of government, COG.
Right.
And that kind of ties into this extinction, near extinction event. By the way, you touched on it briefly. Every 10,000 years, there seems to be an extinction event that happens right. on Earth. And so they have a thing called the continuance of government, which they're not allowed to talk about. Every time it comes up in Congress, they immediately stop the conversation. You can't talk about this. Right. Can you talk about that?
So I'm not an expert in continuance or in what I call COG, but COG is basically a set of laws and plans that says, you know, if something really goes wrong, we want to make sure that the government can continue to operate. It's one of the reasons you have underground bases. And so, you know, I'm saying they're creating a parallel civilization, but continuance of government is really setting up a backup government. So, you know, so to speak, in backup facilities. Now, I think it's really important to understand that one of the risks they're most afraid of is the rest of us. So you understand pretty well all the lies that you've heard. If I were to sit down and get you to write the 100 biggest lies you'd been given by the educational establishment or the media in your whole life, you would have no problem coming up with a very impressive list, right?
Correct.
Okay. There's a point at which people get angry and they decide, okay, I've had it. I'm not going to play along anymore. I'm not going to pretend. You know, I got the story of I am good in my check, but now that my check's getting shorter and shorter and smaller, I'm not going to go along with the story of I am good. I'm not going to play ball. And as you know, we are many and they are few. So having a place to go hide, you know, where you can be safe and secure is something you might want to do before you get the control grid. So part of continuity of government is what happens if the population turns against the leadership.
And the true leadership is not the people that we vote for.
They're part of it. They're part of
right.
it.
Right. They're the tools of the people who actually, you know, the central bankers, for instance. Talk about the, can you very quickly, or how take as much time as you want. talk about, because people don't understand how things are really work and how things are really controlled, and how we started off talking about how Trump is in a box and how he's controlled every president. Talk about the
internet. How is Trump going to push the red button if we won't?
If we won't push the red button, how is Trump going to push the red button?
Right.
You mean to stop this?
Okay, so let me talk about something that's near and dear to my heart. Okay. If you look at the federal budget this year, we spent approximately $857 billion for the military budget. We're spending more now for the interest on the debt. But guess what the HHS budget is that pays Medicare and Medicaid?
Oh, it's got to be several trillion? No, I don't know.
$1.8 trillion. It's right. More than double our military expenses. Okay?
Okay.
And that is coming from what I call the great poisoning. Okay, now.
The great poisoning?
The great poisoning. Americans are being poisoned. If you look from the moment the budget deal in 1995 busted, they started to bring down life expectancy, and it was coming steadily down. If you look at a chart of life expectancy, the other 19 industrial, you know, you look at the top 20 industrial companies, the 19 are going like this, and the U.S. is slowly going like this and then falls off the cliff in the pandemic. So the divergence between the average industrial life expectancy and our life expectancy is diverging hugely, okay? And the problem is, you know, that's not a quick kill, it's a slow kill, and the medical expenses are enormous. Switzerland per capita has $8,500 in healthcare expense. Guess what the U.S. per capita is?
11,000?
13,500.
Okay.
So, you know, now we're not getting better healthcare than Switzerland.
No.
I can assure you of that.
Correct.
So we have a very, very complex system. It's overly expensive. And not only that, we have an explosion, an epidemic of chronic illness, including in children. So Dr. Mark Skidmore of the Missing Money Survey fame just finished publishing something where he calculated if we went back to 2010 levels of disability from our current levels of disability, we would save $500 billion on that budget, HHS. We are spending a fortune on a population which is more and more disabled. You can talk about bringing manufacturing back to the United States, but if we continue to poison the population, we won't be able to generate the productivity that we need to begin to replace what we're canceling, you know, all around the world. Okay? Now, if we want the economy to work, then we're going to have to change. We are. And if you look at what's happened with the effort to change the policies so that we don't poison our children, what the confirmation of Kennedy at HHS said, the failure to get Weldon put into CDC and the switch now on the Surgeon General, what it says to me is the constituencies that want this diminution of life expectancy and want this poison to keep happening, you know, those constituencies are very, very strong. We know that mRNA technology is a killer, and yet we see the president supporting mRNA technology. We see enormous efforts. I just saw a tweet, and I haven't had time to confirm it. Since the beginning of the year, since the Trump inauguration, 2.6 million children have been given mRNA shots. There's been no change in the heavy schedules. We don't need studies to show where autism is coming from. We know where it's coming from. So this, you know, to me, this is nothing short of murder.
Well, so the big thing that, you know, Robert F. Kennedy was talking about how before he became HHS secretary was that they're murdering people with these shots. And MMR vaccine technology was not safe. That's what he was saying. And so now he appoints Marty McCurry, who was also one of the most vocal people speaking out against the COVID vaccines. And everybody was super happy that he got appointed to be the head of the FDA. And so he was, this is just on Sunday, or maybe even yesterday, he was talking about the COVID shots, which are an mRNA shots. And here's what he said.
I'll talk to you about Novavax, if I could. It's a protein-based COVID vaccine you were an enthusiast for back in COVID. Its target date for permanent approval, as I understand it, was April 1. That's now been delayed. Why was it delayed? And if you'd be so kind, what role did your special assistant, Tracy Beth Hogue, play in that process?
So it's what I think they're saying is that they have this new vaccine that doesn't rely on the mRNA technology that they were going to implement, but now they're delaying it. And the newsman is trying to make the issue his assistant, who they've painted as an anti-vaxxer. Okay, so let's listen to what he says.
Well, first of all, Major, good to be with you. And yes, you're right. I have been enthusiastic about non-mRNA COVID vaccines. To help with people who have a tough time with taking mRNA vaccines, I felt that it could increase vaccination rates. The last study that we have showing that it has a clinical benefit was from 2020 and 2021, and it excluded people with prior COVID infection. Now, essentially, everyone has natural immunity. So
why do you want to increase people's uptake of a vaccine to fight something that they have natural immunity? That's my first question. And here's, he goes on.
My general feeling, not with this particular product, which I can't discuss in depth, but with drugs in general, that we need to know if they work today in order to be able to recommend them. So we are asking some companies in general to do clinical studies, a basic clinical study, so we can educate the population and have information to work with. Should a 12-year-old thin, healthy girl get a seventh COVID shot this year? I don't know the answer to that because we don't have good clinical.
Yeah, so we know the answer to that.
He knows the answer to that.
Right.
Why is he lying about the answer to should a young, healthy, thin
lying because he's
girl
he's in the box?
So say it again.
He's lying because he's in the box.
He's in the box.
He's in the box. He's not allowed to say, you know, this is what we call, if you look at what he just did, we call that pretzel. I call that pretzel talk.
Yes.
You know, it's pretzel talk. You know, he's in the box. He's not allowed to say the truth.
That was heartbreaking to me when I saw him say that, because I had, you know, I had full faith and hope. I had hope and faith in RFK Jr. and people like Marty Makary, Jay Bhattacharya, who I know, you know, personally have had on the show several times, people who took slings and arrows, including Marty Makary, and RFK's whole reputation has been trashed for being truth tellers about it. Now they finally have somehow wrestled their way into a position of power to do something about the things that they've been screaming about. And then they say stuff like this.
Right.
And
so politics is the art of getting done options that are politically feasible. And they're in a box where telling the truth about vaccines and getting something done on vaccines is limited. You know, hopefully it's not down to none. Kennedy says he's going to do this big study and it's going to produce the numbers. The numbers, as far as I'm concerned, the numbers are quite clear, but maybe he pulls everything together and produces a study. I'm hoping, unfortunately, maybe he pulls all the data together and links it up with all the data that's been stolen so far, and now we've got a control grid.
And here is a guy, Vinny Prasad, who I've caught lying several times, but he also was late to the game to tell the truth about COVID and took a lot of hits on his reputation. And so Marty Makary just appointed him up to a big shot spot at the FDA, regulating drugs and the regulations. He retweets this interview, which I just showed you a piece of, and he says everything Marty says is spot on. Spot on? So they're all corrupt now. So even the people who took the slings and arrows and had took shots of their reputation, he's sitting there saying it's spot on that we don't know if a healthy 7-year-old girl who's thin needs to take a COVID booster. We don't know that. That's what he's saying. That's what he's saying. I want to go move to Antarctica.
Don't move. That's dangerous. So here is what someone who would defend them. Here's how you defend these guys, and you say they're playing it safe until they can aggregate enough data to punch through, and they can't afford to go out publicly saying it's not safe until they've aggregated the data and they've got their ducks lined up, and you need to give them time. Now, I hope that that's the case, but I don't know that's the case. And if you look at what they've done on a variety of situations, all I can say is they're in a box. It's clear to me from what Trump has done and what Bobby has done and what a series of players has done is the word is, we will implement mRNA technology no matter what. And what I will tell you is I believe that's going to kill a huge number of children.
If not grown adults. So now you talked about this Surgeon General switcheroo.
Right.
So Trump just appointed Kayleigh Means, Dr. Casey Means, to be our next. Now, we know her because she wrote this best-selling book, Good Energy, with her brother, Callie Means. Callie's been on the show. Right. And they tell you a lot of truths about how corrupt and backwards our healthcare system is. They talk about seed oils. They talk about how they don't talk about real nutrition and medical. Well, I'll give you 60 seconds of something she said.
You would think that the American healthcare system and our government agencies would be clamoring to fix metabolic health and reduce American suffering and costs. But they're not. They are deafeningly silent about metabolic dysfunction and its known causes. It's not an overstatement to say that I learned virtually nothing at Stanford Medical School about the tens of thousands of scientific papers that elucidate these root causes of why American health is plummeting and how environmental factors are causing it. For instance, in medical school, I did not learn that for each additional serving of ultra-processed food we eat, early mortality increases by 18%. This now makes up 67% of the foods our kids are eating. I took zero nutrition courses in medical school. I didn't learn that 82% of independently funded studies show harm from processed food, while 93% of industry-sponsored studies reflect no harm. In medical school, I didn't learn that 95% of the people who created the recent USDA Food Guidelines for America had significant conflicts of interest with the food industry. I did not learn that 1 billion pounds of synthetic pesticides are being sprayed on our food every single year, 99% of the farmland in the United States is sprayed with synthetic pesticides, many from China and Germany. And these invisible, tasteless chemicals.
So it's real easy to get excited about her becoming Surgeon General. But then you hear even someone like Nicole Shanahan, who was Bobby Kennedy's running mate. She says this, it's very strange, doesn't make any sense. I was promised that if I supported RFK and his Senate confirmation that neither of these siblings would be working under, she was promised that they would, neither of them would be working in HHS or in an appointment, and the people much more qualified would be. I don't know if RFK very clearly lied to me or what is going on. It has been clear in recent conversations that he is reporting to someone regularly who is controlling his decisions, and it isn't President Trump. With regards to the siblings, there is something very artificial and aggressive about them, almost like they were bred and raised Manchurian assets. So here's what Mary Taylor Bowden, we all know her, she's also another great truth teller and about COVID. She says last week RFK told Dr. Kelly Victory she was the new pick to be Surgeon General. I was with her last weekend, and she told me and others, Kelly was passed over because of her outspoken stance against the mRNA shots. Clearly, RFK actually has no power. And here is Dr. Naomi Wolf. She says, in addition to my analysis of one of the gazillion odd characterizing Casey Means, a $300 million startup valuation and a number one New York Times bestseller, she's having never, ever launched a startup or written a book before. Please bear in mind that Secretary Kennedy, that Maha worked tirelessly to get you and your allies into leadership, and that if there is this much opposition, it's not absurd. It is your base in revolt, and you owe it to your base respectfully to listen and respond accordingly. Our officials work for us. Here's a little bit more. It looks like Trump's advisors are trying to push deep state actors into the Surgeon General's position to keep the whole mRNA plus big tech medicine business viable. MAGA is not keeping its promises to Maha. So it's an absolute tragedy. She has no active medical license, never finished a residency. She's not even qualified to get hospital privileges in the United States system. Are you kidding me? Is she qualified? Then so is Richard Simmons. So RFK goes on and defends her, right? So he does this long Twitter thread where he defends her. And looking at the myriad of comments on Twitter, the real issue is that Dr. Mary Talley Bowden stated that Dr. Kelly's victory was the actual choice. And this was confirmed when Mary was with her last weekend. In addition, Nicole Shanahan stated that she was promised if she backed RFK Jr. that neither one of the Means would be anywhere in HHS. So the root of the matter is that people feel betrayed and that they were lied to. And thus far, no one has been given a good explanation for why. That is where the heart of the problem is. So what do you... So
that is not where the heart of the problem is.
What is the heart of the problem?
The heart of the problem is the American people, 325 million people, spend a lot of time and money trying to change people in the boxes, thinking that swinging the boxes back and forth between the either party is going to get us someplace. And that does, you know, that will get us incremental places. But if we want change, we're going to have to fundamentally change, you know, in our daily lives, where we put our time, where we put our money, who we support, how we support. And you know, if tomorrow everybody pulled their money out of the banks that did the mortgage fraud, did the missing money, if everybody pulled their, you know, take every stock that is guilty of murdering kids with pharmaceutical products and all these games. If we just called, if everyone called their broker and said, you know something, get all of them out of my portfolio. I want nothing to do with them.
That's what I've actually done that. Right. I put my money in gold. Go ahead.
If we simply exercised all the powers of shunning, I mean, if everybody called up, you know, if you have a university who's doing shenanigans in their endowment, we called them and said, you know, that's it. I'm not supporting you. If we shifted our time and our money, you know, especially the most important thing everybody listening to this can do is completely re-engineer your food, your water, and your preventative health so that you walk away from all these healthcare systems because they're dangerous and they lie. And started to support, you know, doctors like Mary. You know, the world is full of great doctors and great healthcare practitioners who are telling you the truth. Let's support them. So if we want to shift the boxes, voting for somebody in the uniparty or getting somebody appointed, you know, when you're in the box, you're under control. I was in the box. I got fired. I got fired because I refused to break the law. They ordered me to break the law. I refused. I got fired.
So if someone like Mary Talley would actually become in the box, she would also get fired, or she'd have to...
Mary would get fired within 60 days, or she'd be dead, or they'd kill somebody in her family. I mean, it would be very dangerous. I mean, John F. Kennedy tried to change the model. He got shot. So every president who's tried... So let's look at the biggest financial fraud in the government. Can you guess what the biggest financial fraud is?
You know, I would point to the Pentagon, but I'm guessing there's a bigger one, right?
So we have $36 trillion of debt. You know why?
Why?
Because we issue the currency with debt-based. We could just issue the currency, right?
Right.
Without debt. Right.
Why
do we have $36 trillion of debt? We just issued the currency. So Lincoln tried to do that. He ended up dead. You know, Andrew Jackson tried to cancel the central bank. They tried to assassinate him. He beat the rap, right? Kennedy had started to propose that we issue greenbacks. You know, he had started to set up issuing greenbacks. No debt-based currency. Boom. He's dead. Right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I've never had anybody who could actually explain to me. They've explained it to me, and I still never understood what they were saying. And I just thought I was because I was dumb. It's like, why, if we can print the money, why do we have to borrow the money? We're printing it and we're borrowing it? That doesn't make any sense.
Right. So you don't. You can just issue the currency. So if you come to Solari, there's a story of Guernsey. Guernsey, at one point, really needed to, you know, build a seawall and do all sorts of infrastructure, and they had no money. So instead of borrowing, they just decided to print, you know, make up their own currency and issue it. And, of course, it created lots of economic activity, and they built the infrastructure they needed to have a much stronger economy. It was a huge success. So I think the problem with the dollar is not that it's fiat. The greatest currencies in the history of the world have been fiat currencies that had great governance systems. I think our problem is it's debt-based, and I think our problem is we have a secret governance system and that is very much out of alignment with the general population. And, you know, whether it's they're poisoning us or they're poisoning us financially, you know, the history of central banking is anytime a civilization legalizes usury, it's only a matter of time until it fails. And if you look at the financial system, we have legalized usury and the amount of money that's being siphoned out of people's pockets by financial. I just saw a great, I don't know if you've ever interviewed Alan Collange, who runs one of the most effective organizations trying to stop all the terrible things going on in student loans. And he just put out a series of graphics. We're going to put them out on our social media that shows how much debt is going to be collected in each state from people, from students in that state, how much interest they're taking out on student loans of the, you know, per state and how that compares to the state budget. And Jimmy, it's absolutely frightening. I mean, they've got the whole, you pick any state, they've got the whole tax basis in a debt trap. It's unbelievable. And now the federal government has said on the Department of Education loans, they're going to enforce against those kids. And that means they're going to garnish wages. They're going to garnish Social Security. This is going to be very, very ugly.
Catherine was telling me this is the she wanted to send me the dangers of being stung by a bee. I guess what that this is about. Or oh, I'm sorry. No.
So this is the Bank of International Settlements is the central bank of central banks.
The Bank of International Settlements, which people have no idea what that bank is. And it's basically like its own country. Nobody controls it, but it controls all our money, right?
It has sovereign immunity, and it coordinates the top 63 central banks, and it's leading a process in many different countries through something called innovation hubs to institute central bank digital currency. And in 2020, Augustine Carsons, who's the general manager of the BIS, was speaking in an IMF panel and explained why he likes CBDCs. Okay, so this
is the head of the Bank of International Settlements, which controls is at the top of the chain of all the central banks in the world, and he's going to tell you why he likes central digital banking currencies.
And before you start, let me just say, because they have sovereign immunity, they have the power to move money globally and keep it on their balance sheet in secret.
Okay.
Okay.
What could go wrong? Okay, let's listen.
Aren't our analysis on CBDC, in particular for the use of general use, we tend to establish the equivalence with cash. And there is a huge difference there. For example, in cash, we don't know, for example, who's using a $100 bill today. We don't know who is using a 1,000 peso bill today. A key difference with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also we will have the technology to enforce that. Those two issues are extremely important, and that makes a huge difference with respect to what cash is.
What he just said was
if we have a pandemic and we decide you're locked down, if you leave your home, your money won't work. Your credit card won't work.
Because they can track you with Elon Musk's Starlink. They'll know where you are at every moment. And other
systems. But right. Because you're in an all digital monetary system with complete surveillance, we'll be able to turn your money on and off if you disobey the rules. And moreover, with AI and software, I can create a set of rules for Jimmy Dore, which are specific to him and where he lives and what he does and whether he's good or not. Remember, with the social credit system, I can track whether you're being good or not. And you know, if you're good and your credit score goes up, then maybe I'll let you go a mile from your home, whereas Catherine's been bad and she can't leave her home. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
So I can create a set of rules, because remember, this control system is one person at a time. I can track you and I can control you, and I can institute enormous set of complex rules, and I can enforce centrally. What he just said is, we will have the technology to enforce. And it's not your money, it's our money, and we can decide when and how you can use it, and we can evolve and change that whenever we want. And that includes taxation without representation. So if you watch the second one, it's the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, one of the 12 Federal Reserve banks, Neel Kashkari, who's at Treasury during the bailouts.
He's going to speak against this.
Yes, he is.
Okay, because I've seen this video before. So just before we get into Kashkari, who ran for governor in California, by the way, what that guy said, the guy who was stung by a bee, what he gave the game away, what he said, so if someone has a $100 bill or a 1,000 peso bill, we don't know who has it and we don't know how they're spending it. More importantly, we can't control it.
Right.
But and with the central digital banking currency controlled by the Bank of International Settlements, we know who has it. It's not theirs, it's ours, and we can control if they spend it or not.
Right. Now, it may be controlled by the national central bank, so it would be presumably controlled by the Fed. But whether it's the Fed or the BIS or the ECB or the Bank of England, they'll have control. Now, Trump has said he doesn't want a CBDC. What he wants is a stable coin, which is just going to be a coin issued by the different guys who own the banks that own the New York Fed, and you can do the same thing. The third video I want you to show, I want to show you, is programmable money. And the issue, Jimmy, is not, is it a CBDC or a stablecoin? The issue is it programmable and is it interoperable with digital IDs and all the other aspects of the control system? Because if it is, it doesn't matter whether it's private or public. You know, it doesn't matter whether the central bank do it or the individual banks.
Right. So people are like, oh, well, you know, Elon Musk wants to have his own currency, and we have PayPal, and we have, you know, it's Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg wants to have his own currency, which is why they had to get rid of that agency, which I'm blanking on, that so they want to be able to act like banks without any of the regulations. The Consumer right. Financial Protection Bureau. So they're gutting that. And they're making it sound like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau are the ones who are debanking people. That's what Mark Andreessen said on Joe Rogan's show, which was a complete lie. And
so here's what you want. What you want is, number one, you do not want an all-digital monetary system. Keep cash alive. Keep checks alive. Keep the analog system. Roll back the digital. The problem is all digital. Okay? So never let the monetary system be all digital, and do everything you can to promote and preserve cash. What you don't want is, you don't want an interoperable national ID, and that's what they're trying to implement with a real ID. So we have a big piece up at Solari, which I'll send to you, that is a checklist of all the different things the Trump administration is doing to build the control grid. And they are moving rapidly and at high speed.
Okay. All right. So let's play. Here's Cash Carry talking about what the beasting guy from the Bank of International Settlements was talking about, how he wants to control everybody. Here's what Cash Carry has to say. Now, he's the head of the Fed in Minneapolis, right?
Right. So he's president of one of the 12 Fed banks.
Okay. So here's what he says.
Asking anybody at the Fed or outside of the Fed to explain to me what problem this is solving.
What problem?
I can send anybody in this room $5 with Venmo right now. Right? No, seriously. So what is it that a CBDC could do that Venmo can't do? And all I get is a bunch of hand waving. I get a bunch. Well, maybe it's better for financial inclusion. Maybe it's better for cross-border remittances. Maybe. Is there any evidence that it is? And, you know, they say, well, what about China? China's doing it. Well, I can see why China would do it. If they want to monitor every one of your transactions, you could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. If you want to impose negative interest rates, you could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. And if you want to directly tax customer accounts, you could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. So I get why China would be interested. Why would the American people be for that?
So should I just play this next one? I mean, that was just amazing what he said.
So he's, I think one of the reasons the Fed's been slow walking this is they don't want their kids to be slaves either. The next guy is Bo Li, who was at the Bank of China, and when he had moved to IMF as a managing director, he's a deputy, and he's talking about programmable money, and this is in 2023.
So he's the at the time he was the deputy managing director at the IMF on bank digital currencies. Okay, here we go. I like that. Go financial inclusion. It sounds so nice. We want to include everybody. Here we go.
Aspect that CBDC can help improve financial inclusion is because of its legal tender status. Because CBDC is an obligation of central bank. And the obligation of central bank is a legal tender in every country. So it is widely accepted. That creates potential value for everyone to use it. And finally, the third way we think CBDC can improve financial inclusion is through what we call programmability. That is, CBDC can allow government agencies and private sector players to program, to create smart contract, to allow targeted policy functions. For example, welfare payment. For example, consumption coupon. For example, food stamp. By programming CBDC, those money can be precisely targeted for what kind of people can own and what kind of use this money can be utilized, for example, for food. So this potential programmability can help government agencies to precisely target their support to those people who need support. So that way can also improve financial inclusion.
It's about helping people. It's about government. It's all about, we're doing this for you. That's why we're censoring, so you don't have to censor yourself, and you don't get bombarded with misinformation. That's why we're doing it for you. So he's doing that so that government can help you spend your money. So what they're talking about, we're going to program this digital currency that can only be spent on a certain thing in a certain way. And if we say we don't want you to be able to spend it anymore, we can just cut you off.
Here's the thing. If I don't like what you're saying, then you only get lab-grown meat. You can't have any of the real stuff.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and we've seen what's happening right now just on college campuses, and it's definitely, if we don't like what you're saying, we're going to turn you into a criminal. Even if you're playing by all the rules, even if you're have a green card, even if you're going to meetings with the immigration officials the way we asked you to become a citizen, we're going to still make you into a criminal and kick you out of our country and kick you out of our colleges and stop your PhD program because we don't like what you're saying.
Right.
It's not what they're doing. It's what they're saying. And, you know, I think is that the head of Palantir, he said a year ago that the fight over on college campuses right now about this kind of freedom of speech, about what's happening in Israel, Gaza. He said that is the fight, because if we lose control of this, he called it an intellectual argument, meaning the narrative. If we lose control of the narrative around Gaza and Israel, and we can't control, and these students are allowed to speak their mind freely, if we lose this, he said, we'll never be able to deploy an army in the Western world ever again. Why? Because people are against war.
So I would say it this way. I would say we do a show on Solari called Money and Markets, and one of our themes was Gaza is a method. So if you look at how we've run the unipolar model, we spent a lot of money on what's called soft power.
So right. If that's USAID and NED.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. What you're watching in Gaza is hard power. Do what we say or we kill you. We want your land. You have to leave or we kill you. Okay. And now that method is going to go global if it works in Gaza. You know, Gaza gets to go early, but if you look at the drones, if you look at the robotics, if you look at all the techniques that have been used and are being used in Gaza, you know, what we face is a control system that is no longer soft power, it's hard power. And part of hard power is having an all digital monetary system, currencies, it's the end of currency, where we go to a set of rules and complete control of your, you know, of where you can work and what you can do and what money you can get and where you can travel and where you can go and where you can live. We're talking about complete control. It's very interesting. We publish wrap-ups every quarter. I'm a great believer as an investor that it's very important to understand what I call the primary trends. And so John Titus, who's the co-host and is a brilliant lawyer, wrote a big thing on the Going Direct Reset, which is what we're in now. It's sort of the central bankers do a reset every 80, 120 years, and we're in one called the Going Direct Reset that started in 2019. So he wrote that, and I asked him to write something on CBDC. And I said to him, this is a slavery system. And John looks at me, you know, I'm an investment banker, so I like to, you know, I'll jump to conclusions because it's important to trade before you get, you know, it's important to guess what it is before you lose the power to act. So investment bankers tend to be quick. John likes hard evidence. You know, he's a lawyer. And so when I told him, John, this is a slavery system, he's looking at me like, you know, you're exaggerating. You're being a little dramatic. You're being whatever. And so he spent weeks and weeks and weeks studying the technology and how it works and what to do. And he came back and he said, oh my God, this is a slavery system. I said, I told you.
So this is the modern day slavery system. This is, and this is how, and part of it.
Right. But this is much worse than slavery. This is much worse than slavery because, you know, slavery is when, you know, they can control you physically. But now we're talking about invasiveness of the body, you know, of literally injecting things into your body that allow them to track what's going on in your body and affect your mind. So we're talking about a level of invasiveness, the likes of which tyranny has never been able to comprehend before.
Okay. So Real ID is part of this, right?
Yes, absolutely. This system requires very high quality precision ID system. I need to make sure you're Jimmy and I'm Catherine, right? And so this is why Kristi Noem is out trying to terrorize people into the Real ID and why since the Patriot Act, they've been trying to get the Real ID adopted. And as you can see, there's still a surprising number of people who refuse to go in. And they're trying to engineer it through the DMVs. They're trying to persuade people you have to have it, which you don't. You can travel. You do need a federal ID to travel, but you know, there are 16 or 17 other federal IDs you can use to travel.
You can use a passport.
The being the passport, right.
You can use a passport. You don't have to get a real ID. So if I get a real ID, how does that differ fundamentally from a regular? So I have a driver's license issued by my government at the DMV. It is not a real ID, but if I would got a real ID, is that the next step? What is that?
I think, and this is my conjecture, I think the real ID system is designed because you're using the DMVs of the states to implement it and maintain it. You can achieve a very high precision and interoperability state to state, but then with countries around the world. And so it can start to link into a global system. That's what they were trying to use the vaccine passports to achieve, but they just couldn't get the population to adopt.
Wow. This is, if you can think it, they've tried it. And that's what I've realized. Go ahead.
Right. So we have one graph that shows that all the different aspects of the control grid. So, you know, there's the all digital monetary system. There's the high precision ID. There's the satellite and other kinds of surveillance. There's the smartphones. They're all. And if you try and talk with most people about them, they'll say, well, I can live with this one thing or I can live with that one thing or this thing is convenient or that's convenient. And they're all very convenient until they snap together, and then you're in a digital concentration camp, and then it stops being convenient, and it starts being slavery.
And so, you know, people, I'm sure the people who voted for Donald Trump thought they were voting for the opposite of this, right?
So I just sent you the link. We just published something called The Fast Approaching Digital Control Grid, a checklist of Trump administration actions to date. It was published on April 16th. There are more since then, and I'll update it at some point. And I wrote it, Jimmy, because the number of things the Trump administration was doing to implement the control grid were so many and so fast, I couldn't remember them all. I just said, I need a checklist. I'm going to do shows and walk people through all of them. We've done a checklist at the beginning of the administration, but it was moving so fast, we needed more. You know, I needed to do it again. Anyway, I sent you the link.
So and, this is the link here. A complete reengineering of the U.S. government through the digital system is now possible at high speed. And so this is a very, this isn't a short article. It's a, the digital control grid is an electronic network of digital telecommunications and information systems that allows individuals to be surveilled, tracked, and made subject to invasive controls applied to their financial transaction and resources such as electricity, food, water, transportation, compromising, if not ending, all human rights and liberties. Control grids operate with a significant data collection and an AI to apply social credit systems that can be dictated on a highly centralized basis. A digital control grid ends financial freedom, replacing markets with technology, a system run by rules created and maintained by centrally by experts. Is the Trump administration building a digital control grid? We provide the following checklist to assess the steps the administration is and is not taking in a variety of areas to facilitate a rapid control grid build-out. We invite subscribers to post suggestions in the... So they're... Okay.
Okay, so I'm sending you a link now. We have a website dedicated to financial freedom, and we've been working with individuals and investors in the states on what they can do. And in fact, this it's not too late to turn this all around. So I sent you a link to the website, and there's a wealth of resources, including... you know, documents that show what individuals can do and what your state legislators can do. And there's a tremendous amount that we can all do.
So here it is, the Solari Report, and it's the Financial Transaction Freedom 2025. The Fight for Finance, the Solari Report offers complimentary subscription. Okay, the Fight for Financial Transaction Freedom. Financial transaction freedom is the ability to use multiple options to make contracts and affect transactions on a timely basis at reasonable cost without interference. This freedom must be protected at all costs. Central banks are using digital systems to limit or end such freedom, something they cannot do if citizens, local banks, credit unions, and municipalities and states act together. Our goal is to support leaders working to protect financial transaction freedom and to help our subscribers and audience to support them and their legislative and regulatory efforts. So do you really think this is possible, that we could stop this train?
Yep. So yes. I, you know, when you look at the history of freedom, it always looks hopeless until freedom just, you know, and the great thing about freedom is we don't need an organization. We don't need, you know, a central government. We don't need a central bank. We can just act together for freedom. And, you know, one of my favorite stories, we have a podcast called Over the Mountain that Senator Nicely from Tennessee does, who I think was one of the greatest state legislators who has ever been. And he tells the story of the Over the Mountain Men. Have you ever heard this?
No.
Okay. So this is a typical freedom story. At the towards the end of the Revolutionary War, George Washington declared that the Americans lost. He said, all hope is lost. And it was right before the Battle of King Mountain. And the British had basically attacked a group of settlers in North Carolina who had escaped and had gone over the mountain. They were called the Over the Mountain Men, and they lived in East Tennessee. And anyway, so the British commander before the Battle of King Mountain sent a message to the settlers who had run over the mountain. He said, you know, don't come over. And if you do, we'll kill you and piss on your grave. And sure enough, if you go into the Tennessee treasurer's office or the speaker's office, they have this huge painting of the Over the Mountain Men who gathered at Sycamore Hill and went over the mountain and were instrumental in defeating the British at the Battle of King Mountain. And that turned the war, and the Americans won, despite the fact Washington thought it was too late and all hope was lost. So Nicely always tells that story because he always says, you know, it always looks hopeless until then, you know, bunch of ornery guys. And what's, I'll tell you the interesting part of the story, and I'm just quoting Nicely. In fact, they killed the British commander, and they did piss on his grave because that's how we are in Tennessee.
Ah. this is being touted as a massive loss for Israel. Trump is going to grant Saudi Arabia a peaceful nuclear program without demanding normalization with Israel in return. This is according to here it is, from the Times of Israel. Trump drops Biden's demand that Saudis recognize Israel in a nuclear deal with the United States. So this is right from the Times of Israel. The United States is no longer demanding Saudi Arabia normalize ties with Israel as a condition for progress on civil nuclear cooperation talks. Two sources with knowledge of the matter tell Reuters, ahead of the U.S. President Donald Trump's visit next week, Washington would be making a major concession by dropping the demand that Saudi Arabia establish diplomatic relations with Israel. Under former U.S. President Joe Biden, nuclear talks were an element of a wider U.S.-Saudi deal tied to normalization with Riyadh's goal of a defense treaty with Washington. The kingdom has repeatedly said it would not recognize Israel without a Palestinian state, frustrating Biden administration attempts to expand the Abraham Accords signed during Trump's first term. Under those accords, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco normalized relations with Israel. Progress towards Saudi recognition of Israel has been halted by fury in Arab countries over the war raging in Gaza. The nuclear talks had also stumbled over Washington's non-proliferation concerns. So Lindsey Graham tweeted this out. I've been working on and supportive of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel for years. This historic agreement would effectively end the Arab-Israeli conflict and allow the regions to march towards the light and away from darkness, building on the historic Abraham Accords. However, I would like to make it crystal clear that I will never support a defense agreement with Saudi Arabia or other elements of a proposed deal that does not include normalizing the relationship with Israel as a part of the package. Normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel is an essential element. So that's Lindsey Graham being Israel first and being America second. And here, Mel, who we've quoted lots at this, says, she says, these traitors have no problem placing Israel's interest above our own. This statement is so batshit insane, it's hard to believe it's real. Who the hell do you actually work for? So here's, this guy's very good at breaking stuff down, and he says, another sign that the Trump administration is moving to free the United States from the Zionist chokehold. Israeli media reports that Washington no longer demands a Saudi normalization with Israel as a precondition for deeper strategic ties and help with creating civilian nuclear infrastructure. If this is true and remains this way, Saudi Arabia deserves respect for its steadfastness. They never agreed to formally abandon Palestine and normalization over its head and normalize over its head. And the pressures have been immense. If this is true and remains this way, this signifies a huge blow to Netanyahu's regional aspirations, which sought to accomplish two strategic objectives, regime change in Iran and normalization with Saudi Arabia, which incorporated the erasure of Palestine. I want to wait a little bit longer before I really celebrate this, and it's hard to celebrate anything when disgusting degenerate Israeli continues the bloodbath. Still, there are multiple signs already that MAGA USA, as opposed to Democrats and liberal USA, has some limits and self-respect as regards Israeli-dictated foreign policy. This could also be why they're having an anti-Semitism push to distract, confuse, and weaken their Israeli-first opponents. If this is true and remains true, it means the terrible historic catastrophe of the last 18 months will end with a political victory for Palestine and a crushing defeat for Zionism, Israel, AIPAC, and Netanyahu. So let me just throw it to you. And what do you think this is true?
No, until I see the money cut off from funding the Gaza genocide, I'm not. I'm going to be a tough guy. Okay. The United States right now does not have a sovereign government. We don't have financial sovereignty, and we don't have information sovereignty. And the Israeli first policy is at the very heart of, you know, certainly the compromise of information sovereignty, probably as well as financial sovereignty. I want to see sovereignty return to the United States. So this, you know, this sounds like a good development, and I hope Trump is moving in that direction. But if you, you know, that's like saying we've moved an inch towards something where we need a mile. I think we need a paradigm shift on this whole issue.
And I just want to ask you, about Doge, right? And so at first I was super excited about Doge because I have switched on that. Thomas Massie also, they were supposed to have a vote on cutting money that Doge had found to be fraudulent and what have you. He says this wasn't widely covered in the news, so I'll tell you. Congress was scheduled to vote on rescissions this week to cut the waste that Doge found. But the votes were quietly canceled. USAID and other programs like the PBS and NPR were to be targeted, but they canceled it. So in early 2020, he links to this Grok explanation. In early 2025, House Republican leaders tentatively planned to vote on a rescissions package proposed by President Donald Trump during the week of May 5th, 2025. The package, expected to be sent to Congress in April 2025, aimed to cancel $9.3 billion in previously approved funding, primarily targeting foreign aid programs, the State Department, and public broadcasting entities like PBS and NPR. The rescissions process, governed by the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, allows the president to propose canceling appropriated funds, which Congress must approve within 45 days of continuous session via a simple majority vote in both chambers. The fast-track procedure was seen as a way to formalize spending cuts, particularly those pushed by the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, led by Elon Musk, while avoiding legal challenges to unilateral executive actions. However, the vote did not occur as planned. In summary, while a rescission vote was scheduled for early May, it did not happen due to a combination of political opposition, historical caution, blah, blah, blah. Posts on Twitter also noted significant Republican discontent with the proposed cuts, suggesting that the package ran into a buzzsaw of opposition from both House and Senate Republicans, further undermining its chances. And this guy says that's total horseshit. Thomas Massie says, sir, I serve in the Congress, so I have firsthand sources. Grok provided a good summary, which I verified before posting. So Thomas Massie was asked about this a while ago. Did he think that the cuts from Doge was actually going to happen? Here's what he said.
Also Doge. I think that's going to be a great committee, a great aspect to bring to Congress. But the Doge recommendations are like the Constitution. If you can get my colleagues to follow them, they're going to be great. And so that's really the sticking point here. And I hope the president does use his position, the bully pulpit, to get Congress to cut spending, to pare our government down using Doge recommendations.
So there he was, skeptical that this was going to happen. And he's been proven correct that they're not doing it. So Doge is a complete smokescreen. And even if they did cut that money, Trump has already promised that money to go back into the war machine, the Pentagon. So if they saved $150, $60, $70 billion with Doge, Trump is trying to increase the Pentagon budget exactly that amount. So he basically is just cutting out the middleman, which is the soft power, and giving it right to the hard power. And Doge, right, the guy who runs Doge, Elon Musk, is the biggest defense contractor in the world. So he's basically just taking that money from Doge and putting it into his own pocket because, you know, let's face it, his money's tied to Tesla stock, and Tesla stock is going down faster than a celebrity at a Diddy party. So he needs that. Go ahead.
But if you want to build a control grid, the most valuable data for your private AI is very high quality payment data. And you've gone to Social Security, you've gone to IRS, and you've gone to Treasury. And it looks to me, and there's debate about how much they've gotten, You've basically taken $1 trillion plus worth of data and privatized it into Grok and Palantir AI, where it can be used for the enforcement machine that the head of the BIS just explained to you. He said, we can make the rules and we can enforce them centrally. But to do that, you need very superb, high quality data. And that's what
So that was the real purpose of Doge.
That's what it looked like to me, because they knew if I was going to stop fraud in the government, If I was going to stop fraud in the government, the first thing I would do is I'd go to the Treasury and the New York Fed and the bank statements, and I'd look at where all that $21 trillion went. But they didn't do that. If I wanted to build a social credit system with very high quality control, and I wanted to re-engineer government cash flows to implement control, I would go to the IRS, Social Security, I would go to the Treasury, and then I would go to HHS. And sure enough, Bobby has said he's pulling together a huge, enormous database of, you know, this and that of private and public data. That's where you go.
And it was, you know, Steve Bannon was on the show, and he made the point that if you can tell if they're serious, if DOGE is serious, if they go across the Potomac and they audit the Pentagon and cut, and they didn't. In fact, they're increasing the budget with even after the Pentagon has never been able to pass an audit. Not only are they not going to audit them, they're going to just give them all the savings, quote, which they're not even cutting, that they found from DOGE. They're just giving that to the Pentagon. So we, again, it's way worse.
Well, but,
go ahead.
Yeah. So if you look at where, you know, the administration comes in, you cancel the White House ethics officer, and then you proceed to fire 18 IGs. Many of those IGs were leading investigations into Musk's companies. A government special employee is not allowed to be involved in things that impact their private interests. And it's a criminal violation for a government special employee to be involved. And we know that Musk, in his capacity as government special employee, was meeting with Modi and other world leaders and pitching them on getting Starlink contracts and other contracts. So, you know, and there are other, I mean, if you look at the conflicts of interest between what Musk and DOGE was doing and what was going on in the administration, it's quite, I mean, it's certainly worthy of a special prosecutor. Now, I say that, and I've seen presentations from many people going in under the DOGE umbrella who are very talented software developers or business people, and I think they are sincerely trying to upgrade systems and do sincere things. So it's probably a mixed bag. I will say this. The Trump group has been in the administration before, and if you look at how you go about doing government reengineering, they purposely, and they use these words, they use shock and awe, instead of using the techniques you would use if you really wanted the cuts to stick and you really wanted to get something done. So their techniques and their communications were contrary to effective and successful government reengineering. And I say that as somebody whose company was the leader in government reengineering once upon a time, before the Department of Justice shut us down.
Wow. Okay. This has been the heaviest interview I think I've ever done.
So I just have to say, Jimmy, one of the reasons I love listening to your show is you really help me maintain my state of amusement, which I think is really important. You know, if we're going to get anything done, we have to, you know, we have to come at it. I used to have a deputy at HUD who would say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of new. So we always have to be creating into it. So I appreciate you because you help me maintain my state of amusement. But I feel like I spent this whole interview destroying your state of amusement, and I feel terrible.
No, you should feel terrible. But I got caught hoping. And I was talking with Chris Hedges, and he turns out to be right about this. And I said, you know, I don't have faith that Trump and Elon are going to do what they say they're going to do, but I have hope. I don't have faith. I have hope. And, you know, the fact that it looked like somebody in the deep state was trying to kill Trump. Now, I don't even know if that was real. That gave me hope, actually, in a weird way. That gave me hope that he was a threat to somebody. But it turns out. Go ahead.
I think, you know, the job of a diligent media is to make it a lot easier for the guys who are in the box to do the right thing and a lot harder for them to do the wrong thing. So you always want to get the players in the box to do the best they can. But it's time the American people stand up and realize If we will change our behavior and our actions and work effectively in our families, in our local governments, in our state governments to shift this, we can shift this. We do not need the people in the box to shift it, but we have to take those actions. You know, if everybody tomorrow woke up and used cash as much and as often as they could, there would be a revolution. If everybody said, all these banks that are doing the criminal stuff, I'm going to quit my, I'm not going to work there, and I'm not going to bank there, and I'm going to pull my money out, and I'm going to go to a good, honest bank, there'd be a revolution.
Well, my money's in a credit union. The money that I have in a bank is in a credit union.
Very good.
I took my money out of Wall Street, probably stupidly a long time ago, because I just didn't want to be involved with that stuff. And
You don't want to invest in BlackRock?
I don't want to invest in BlackRock or Raytheon or Shell Oil. I don't want to invest in those places, or, you know, Goldman Sachs. And so I took my money out and I put my money in, you know, things like gold. And
well, gold has outperformed the stock market. So,
yes. Yes, yeah. Gold is doing very well right now, in fact. And right. I'm thinking, what do you think about Bitcoin?
So at Solaria, I've got a wonderful thing. I'll send you the link called Bitcoin Bailout. I think Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme.
Ah, so it's right. It's not the answer, because everybody says nobody has control of it. It's a blockchain. You can't control it.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. The way you control financial products is by controlling the people who control the financial products.
Uh-huh.
You know, whether you shoot them or you have a control file or you put a ringer in there. You know, anybody who says that doesn't understand how control works, really. So I will send you a link to Bitcoin Bailout. If I could make a recommendation, the best book ever written on Bitcoin was written by Roger Ver and Steve Patterson called Hijacking Bitcoin. And it takes you into the inside game of how they hijacked Bitcoin and turned it from what could have been, you know, a very interesting payment, you know, something that had payment utility and really build a community of people worldwide who could transact with each other, how they hijacked it and turned it into a Ponzi scheme.
And so where do you recommend people put their money? You say take it out of those Wall Street?
So now, actually, I invest in the stock market, but I only invest in companies. I have an investment screen company, and I only invest in companies that I've screened. And I know they're good. There are millions of good, there are thousands of good companies all around the world doing great things. They don't, you know, not corrupt. They're just, you know, they're making useful products or doing useful services, and there's a ton of them. So, you know, I love investing in good companies because I believe in enterprise. The way a society creates real wealth is not by putting money in a vault and watching it, but, you know, in building enterprises like building the Jimmy Dore Show or building the Solari Report or building, you know, Massey has, I think, 30 patents and had a very successful company, you know, before he sold it and decided to go into politics. So I love enterprises. My favorite kind of investment, of course, I invest in precious metals. I like precious metals, but my favorite investment is people. And if you look at our society, the misallocation, you know, everybody's busy putting their money into the national security state or putting it in gold and hiding it instead of putting it in people. And we're destroying, you know, that's why I keep coming back to the great poisoning and what we're doing to the kids. We're destroying our people. So I invest a lot of money in people, and I keep telling everybody, the currency of the future will be relationships of trust. You know, the way we're going to move out of this into something worth being part of is one person and one family at a time. And it's those people, you know, whether it's young people growing up and starting enterprises or those relationships that are going to make it all go. And what I discovered as an investment advisor is, you know, my clients were being told by their financial planners, you got to have $25 million in the national security state or you won't be safe. And meantime, their kids are, you know, taking out student loans to go to college and getting, you know, hooked in usurious forms of systems. And they can't buy a home because they don't have enough money. Their parents are too busy financing the national security state. So we've got to reverse and start investing in, you know, in building people and in building the enterprises that you know, that, that build real family wealth. So I love great companies and enterprises. You know, I have two companies, and I put a lot of my money gets reinvested in building those companies, both the Salieri Report and Salieri Investment Screens. And then, I just, you wouldn't believe how much money I spend lending or supporting, helping people.
So can people hire you as a, could I hire you to be?
No, I stopped doing investment advisory because the regulations got so intense. It just became too difficult to do. And I changed the investment advisory to a screen company. So I do investment screens, and I work with other money managers. You know, and people hire those money managers, not me.
Okay. Catherine Austin Fitz, it's been a real eye-opener, earth-shatterer, groundbreaker. I'm sure you've broken a lot of people's ideas about how things work. Certainly you did mine. And you're welcome back on the show. I really appreciate you being so generous with your time, and thanks for the kind words about the show. I didn't know you were watched, but I'm really flattered, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay. I'm happy to come back anytime, Jimmy. You have a wonderful day, and get a good night's sleep.
I'll try. Hey, what part of the country are you in?
So I live half the year in Netherlands. Our audio video team is in the Netherlands, and I love the Netherlands. My home in the United States is in Tennessee. I'm talking to you from Pennsylvania, where I also have an apartment. So I'm very much, I'm on the road about 4 to 5 months a year, just meeting with Salieri Report subscribers, because we really, you know, we need to do this together. And so we like to get together a lot. And I'm sure that's why you do all your events.
Yes.
You know, we need to come together. We need to discuss these things together, and we need to be our own intelligence network.
Okay. Great advice. All right. Catherine Austin Fitz, thanks again. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Come see us live in Los Angeles, Buffalo, Toledo, Montreal, Ottawa, Glasgow, Manchester, Belfast, Dublin, London, Liverpool, Birmingham. Go to jimmydore.com for a link for tickets.